This episode of Access Utah was first broadcast in August of 2018.
Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. One beautiful September day, three men convene on Martha's Vineyard, friends ever since meeting in college circa the 60s. They couldn't have been more different then or even today. Lincoln is a commercial real estate broker, Teddy a tiny press publisher, Mickey a musician beyond his rockin' age. Each man holds his own secrets, in addition to the monumental mystery that none of them has ever stopped puzzling over since a Memorial Day weekend right here on the Vineyard, 1971, the disappearance of the woman each of them loved, J.C. Rockefeller. Now, more than 40 years later, as this new weekend unfolds, three lives are displayed in their entirety, while the distant past confounds the present like a relentless squall of surprise and discovery. It's the plot in brief of the new novel from Pulitzer Prize-winning author Richard Russo. The new book is Chances Are. Richard Russo is author of eight novels, including Everybody's Fool and That Old Cape Magic, two collections of stories, the memoir Elsewhere. In 2002, he received the Pulitzer Prize for Empire Falls, which, like Nobody's Fool, was adapted to film in a multiple award-winning HBO miniseries. Richard Russo, welcome to the program.
Well, it's great to be here, Tom.
So this one, it's friendships. That's an ongoing theme, class divisions. This particular book is a mystery as well. That's somewhat new. Did you know going in you wanted to write a mystery?
No. As a matter of fact, if I had known I was going to be writing a thriller, I might have thought twice about it, because the book is a little bit outside my normal wheelhouse. Although what I did kind of know was that this book would be a little bit more tightly structured. A lot of my books are fairly freewheeling. I let my characters tell me what the book is about. And they are generally kind enough to do that. In this book, though, this is a book about secrets and lies. And which means you're gonna have a bit more plot than normal. And so as I began to discover exactly what these characters what their secret lives were all about, it became necessary to figure out how information was going to be dispensed by the reader, because if you tell everybody up front what the secrets are, that doesn't work very well. So very soon I found myself plotting in a way that would reveal certain things, would reveal information, dole it out in small doses. That's what I love. What I love most about thrillers, although I usually don't write those. Both movies, if we're talking about movies or television or in book form, I really kind of like the slow burn, if you know what I mean. You know, where mm-hmm. where instead of beginning the book on a roller coaster ride. You begin with the doling out of information, and certain things don't quite add up, and the reader begins to get a little bit nervous, and then other things don't kind of add up, and they get more nervous. And suddenly, everything about the book, you think certain things are at stake, and then you realize that actually there's more at stake than you imagined until finally you find yourself in kind of a gripping and relentless situation. That's what I like about good thrillers and movies and TV, and that's what I like about them in fiction.
So you're writing about three friends here, really four, because J.C. Appears through the memories, the feelings that all three have for her. So these are friends. These are old friends. I don't know. The stakes higher there with old friends.
Well, I think so. Especially when their friendships are defined the way they are in this book. These are. I mean, there's a lot about chance in this book. And chance is the title. Chances are. But there are a lot of moving parts to this particular friendship. And you know, you mentioned class before, and all my works have a component of class in them. And in this case, part of the basis for this friendship is class oriented, in that they all go to this same shishi, very expensive liberal arts college on the coast of Connecticut. And of course, what all three of these young men at the time, what all three of them have in common is that in terms of class, none of the three really belong there. None of them have anything like a safety net. They don't come from wealth. And they're being introduced to a world that is entirely new to them. And so they become friends. They think of themselves as the Three Musketeers, all for one and one for all. And that's partly as a result of the fact that all the other, or most of the other students who are in that college have parents who can afford the staggering tuition, and who come from money, and who have certain expectations about what money can and cannot buy, none of which Lincoln and Teddy and Mickey have any experience of. So there are those class issues that bind them together when they are young men. And since, you know, all three have had really interesting lives, those lives have not ended in riches. And so when they come together again at 66, they find that some of those bonds have been tested, but they're still powerful and strong in kind of the way that they are. I mean, I grew up in the same situation as all of these young men. I didn't have any, certainly didn't have any family safety net. And as a result of the various blessings that I've had as a published author and a prize winner, my life has gotten easier now than it certainly was when I was growing up. But if you've spent a considerable portion of your life without money, you never kind of lose that orientation. Does that make any sense? Mm-hmm. That even when your life has gotten easier and you have a little bit more money in the bank, and life has taught you that in addition to going badly at times, it can also go very well, and you can be very fortunate and you can be very blessed. Those early experiences of not having not coming from wealth, not being able to depend upon other people if you make bad decisions, that sense of the world never entirely goes away, or at least it certainly hasn't for me.
Mm-hmm. I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about, you know, it's just a thumbnail sketch of each of these three. Maybe we'll start with Lincoln Moser. He's the person who owns that house that they're gathering at. He's the person who organized this get-together.
Yeah, Lincoln comes from a part of, all three of these characters actually come from a part of my own personality, things that I've thought about, choices that I've made at various times in my life. Lincoln is, of the three friends, he is the most conservative. And when I say conservative, I mean both politically and kind of emotionally. Politically, he is the lifelong Republican of the party. Of the three, he lives out west. He is the son of a man who was part owner in a mostly played out copper mine in Arizona. But his mother, who is a very, very quiet, circumspect, obedient woman in her marriage, has inherited this cottage on Martha's Vineyard. And it's the one thing that she refuses to turn over to her husband. She bequeaths this property, which has increased in value over the years,
almost exponentially as the island has become more famous and Xixi. And Lincoln has inherited this property, and the book kind of begins with him arriving there, unfortunately, as a result of the economic downturn, the Great Recession, going there thinking that he's going to have to sell this property. So that's Lincoln. Teddy is the son of high school English teachers, and as he puts it, their lives were full of kids before he ever came along, and they can barely find time for him amongst their classes and their students and their paper grading, and Teddy grows up, he's kind of one kid too many, and so he is, and like Teddy, even as he, as I was at his age, I was profoundly interested very early in girls before I had, you know, the necessary courage to even talk to them, much less ask for a date. That was me, and that's Teddy in his inner life. He's very interested, but also, like me, he has at that age. I had a religious or spiritual side. I was an altar boy, right up through high school, and so even as I was flirting with the idea of being a ladies' man, I was also flirting with the idea of being, if not a priest, having some sort of large spiritual component in my life, and that's kind of Teddy's origins. Mickey is in some ways the simplest, kind of psychologically, of these three characters, because he really has only one desire in life, and that is to play rock and roll. I just turned 70, but even at that age, if the right song comes on the radio, I have but one desire, and that's to strap on an electric guitar, plug it into an amp, and play rock and roll music. And I did that as a young man, played in a band, and when I was in college, I put myself in part through graduate school, playing 12-string guitar in bars. So Mickey draws on that other aspect of my younger life.
Mickey is in some ways the least changed, right? He's still rocking out at that age.
Yeah. And music, of course, plays a very, very large part in this book. And it's largely through Mickey, whose sense of identity, much more than Lincoln's or Teddy's, is really located in music. And so a song like Chances Are, which gives the title to this book, the Johnny Mathis song, is of course much made fun of and much derided, as is Teddy's and Lincoln's musical taste. But in the song Chances Are, there's one magical night when these three friends are together back in 1971, when even Mickey has to appreciate the schmaltzy lyrics of Chances Are, because what all three of these young men and the girl that they are all three profoundly over their heads in love with, they despite the times, the Vietnam War is raging, Mickey has a very low draft number, and it looks like he will be heading off to Southeast Asia within probably months. But there's this one night that all three of these young men and this beautiful wild child, young woman, come together, and in the dark night on this deck of this house in Martha's Vineyard, sing the lyrics to Chances Are, because all four of them want so desperately to believe that their chances are awfully, awfully good, as the song says. Mm. And throughout, that song kind of haunts the novel, as does my beloved Grace Slick, who who signals the theme of the novel in her lyric from the famous Jefferson Airplane song, "Somebody to Love," when the truth is found to be lies and all the joy within you dies. So Mickey, we get an awful lot of mileage out of the music of the late 60s and early 70s in this book, and Mickey, of course, gets to deride so much of contemporary music, which was also fun.
Yeah, he thumbs through Lincoln's playlist, right, and makes fun of all the songs. That's one.
Yeah. And he makes fun of the various Pandora playlists that Lincoln has on his phone. And later on, Teddy's musical interests right now are much more contemporary. And Lincoln offers to cure his Mumford and Sons disorder, as he calls it,
right.
at one point in the novel.
That's right.
So, yeah, you get to play with the old stuff and the new stuff as well.
So, JC, they're all three in love with JC back in the day.
Yeah.
She still has a big impact in their lives, even though after that original week on Martha's Vineyard, she disappeared. But she's still very much, in a way, part of this... of this weekend, all those years later. Tell us a little bit about JC.
Yeah, it's 45 years later or thereabouts, 44 years later, and this young woman still haunts them in a way that it probably would be much more difficult for her to do had she not disappeared.
Mm-hmm.
You know, her disappearance is part of the reason that they continue to think about her. So hauntingly for so very long. And of course, these guys are now 66 years old, the age I was when I started writing this book. But these are now, it's wrong really to call them middle-aged men anymore. These guys are on the cusp of old age, and they suffer from lower back pain, and they have to get up several times in the middle of the night to pee and all of that. But JC, of course, remains as young as she was when they saw her last, as young, as beautiful, as free, as vibrant, as full of life. She hasn't aged. And so they can still not only be kind of in love with her all this time later, but she remains perfect by virtue of her disappearance. And so, I mean, and it's also complicated by the fact that, of course, back in the day when they were all so thrillingly in love with her, they were not only in love with her, but they were in love with two other things, the first of which being the spirit of the times. This was not just a beautiful girl. This was a beautiful, free girl who was this kind of the spirit of the early 70s, the Woodstock generation. I don't describe her an awful lot physically beyond the fact that she has curly dark hair and olive skin, but like so many girls of the time, she goes around braless and she's kind of free-spirited and is kind of an emblem of what freedom meant to young people, 20-somethings. Back in 1971. So she hasn't aged. She's still an emblem of freedom, even at a time when all three of these young men, now old men, have learned something about freedom and how difficult it is to hold on to as you age. And she also, the second thing that's important about JC is that not only have they fallen in love with her and what she represents in terms of freedom, but also she's from Greenwich, Connecticut. She's the girl who belongs at this college, whose parents can afford the staggering tuition, whereas these young men are all scholarship kids who have to sling hash in a sorority house to make ends meet. JC comes from wealth. She comes from privilege. And these young guys are getting their first glimpse at a world that they know nothing about. So they fall in love with her, but they also fall in love with privilege, with wealth, of an easier, less less stressful life where doors seem magically to open. And so they're in love with her, but they're in love with Greenwich, Connecticut, and they're in love with this Minerva College that I invented, and all the freedom and privilege that those things embody.
If you just joined us, we are talking with the Pulitzer Prize-winning novelist Richard Russo. The new book is Chances Are, and it's a novel set back in the 70s and closer to today, as three young men then, now older, gather for another weekend at Martha's Vineyard. Let's take a break. When we come back, more with Richard Russo. You're listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. My guest is Pulitzer Prize-winning author Richard Russo. The new novel is Chances Are. So Richard Russo, the Vietnam War, the draft, hovers over this novel. These three, of course, were part of the draft, as every young man was. And this gets into this theme of fate and how much do we control and how much is luck or fortune or God's will, or whatever it might be. I wonder if you talk a little bit about that. And I understand that you gave one of your characters your own draft number.
Yeah, Teddy, the middle of these three musketeers, gets the draft number 322. That was mine. And I remember vividly that. I mean, this is really the kind of the inspiration for this book, was that one evening. Back in 1969, the first Vietnam draft lottery, and I remember I don't think I could have given it words back then. I couldn't have articulated necessarily what I was feeling then, and it's difficult even to articulate even now. But I did have a profound sense that when we entered that room that night, as these young men do, because I was a hasher. I was out west at the University of Arizona, so I wanted to change all of that. But I do remember that we, all the hashers, many of us who were in that lottery, we asked the house mother if we could stay later that night and bring in a TV. There was this small room in the back of the sorority house where those of us who served dinner and washed pots and all the stuff that you have to do in a kitchen. We asked if we could stay late and keep the room open and watch the draft lottery on a tiny black and white TV with rabbit ears that had to be constantly adjusted. And we were I remember that when we went into the room, there was a sense of it was a jovial atmosphere, but more importantly, a sense that we were all in the same boat. This was something that was happening not to us as individuals, but to all of us. And being 19 or 20, as we were, we were able to think in our own minds. We were part of us knew that what was happening here was serious, not only serious, but perhaps deadly serious, lethally serious, depending on what our numbers, depending on the number we drew, the trajectory of our lives we're all about to change. But also being 19 or 20, we thought, well, let's, you know, since this is happening to us, we should bring beer. You know, we brought six packs of beer and loaded it up with ice, and as the lottery began with ping pong balls popping up with birth dates on them, you know, we popped our beers and made terrible, terrible jokes to each other. One of the guys I remember got the number 9, and I gave that number to Mickey. And we made terrible jokes about what was happening. But somewhere along the line, probably, you know, 50 or 60 numbers in, The lethal seriousness of what was happening began to take over, And we began to slip away. Those who had their numbers began to slip away because they needed to go home and call their parents because they knew their parents were watching. This was long before cell phones. So we began to go home to our dorm rooms to call our parents. I remember I was there to the end because my number came so close to the end. But I remember vividly leaving the Hasher room and walking across campus to the library where my girlfriend, then and now wife of 47 years, was waiting for me to tell her, you know, my own draft number, my own personal destiny. And by the time the evening was over, what we all realized was that we were not all for one and one for all. We were not, yes, we were friends. Yes, we were great friends, and we understood the power of our friendships. But we weren't all in the same boat anymore. Some of us were in very small, very leaky boats, and some of us were in sturdier vessels, and some of us, like me, lucky on that day when I needed to be lucky, some of us were safely ashore. And that, for young men that age, that's a pretty powerful realization. It's the kind of thing you can know intellectually, but not emotionally. And one of the great things that's happening on this book tour, which I didn't anticipate, I might have, but I didn't, is that on the road now, at the end of my, you know, readings and Q&As, when people come up to sign, get their book signed, person after person wants to tell me what their draft number was and how it changed their lives. And not just guys, you know. Women want to tell me that, you know, about their brothers and their fiancés, their lovers, how they waited to find out what the people they loved, what their destiny was now going to be as a result of that draft lottery.
One thing that really struck me, I was reading an interview with your publisher. You said your number 322, which puts you into safety, very very lucky number. That number has haunted you ever since.
It has. Yeah, it absolutely has. And I've allowed some of that haunting to creep into this book in ways that were difficult, but that I'm very proud of, actually, because there's a scene in the book, without giving too much away, there's a scene in the book in which Mickey's old man he and his son are in a diner, and Mickey is trying to explain to him that and his father's a World War II veteran, explaining to him the insanity of this war, and his father doesn't argue at all. He says, "Of course, we all know this is crazy, and we all know that nobody should go." But his father says, "Somebody's going to, and if not you, who?" And he challenges Mickey. He says, "Look around this restaurant. Bunch of guys in here your age. If you don't go, who do you think you should go? Show me the guy that you think should go." And I got lucky. I got incredibly lucky. I drew that draft number that put me in safety. But I've always, and as I've gotten older, more and more, become more and more haunted by that number. And that's why this book is dedicated to those whose names are on the wall. And I was in it kind of doubly like Mickey. There were two wars that were kind of being fought in my psyche at the time. There was the Vietnam War that was insane, that was based on presidential lies, Nixon first and foremost, but he wasn't the first president to lie to the American people about what was going on over there. And so there was the Vietnam War that was that was the issue. But for men like Mickey, whose father was a World War II veteran, there's the other war too that is still part of the American imagination at that time, because my father was a Normandy guy. So part of you know, the haunting of my 322 number it's partly me, but it's also a son following in the footsteps of a legitimate war hero. My father made it from Normandy all the way to Berlin, and here I was, someone protesting a war that came along when it was my turn. So yeah, I mean, and I'm sorry, that's a very long answer to a short question, but you know, it's amazing how many men my age have been similarly haunted. When I was my daughter tried for almost a year to get me, my wife and I, tickets to Bruce Springsteen's Broadway show. I don't know if you've seen that or not, Tom.
I haven't. No.
But there's a wonderful. I mean, the music is everything you would expect from The Boss. It's just glorious. But it's the storytelling that really wrecks you. And he tells this wonderful story about him and his friends going to the draft board, trying to convince them that they were all crazy, you know, so that the draft board wouldn't think that they were Army material, which of course had exactly no effect on them. And you know, some of them were drafted, and some like Bruce were not. And some of them came home safely, and some of them died. And Springsteen says, "I don't know who died in my place, but somebody did." So that kind of haunting, I think, is the particular legacy of my generation.
Mm.
And this book kind of snuck up on me in the sense that I hadn't. This is not a book that I'd been thinking about writing for a very long time or anything like that. But suddenly there it was, all of it at once.
So very much related, and thank you for the, that's I think that helps me understand a lot. A very much related question. You mentioned earlier there's a strong theme of fate. You know, chances are the title in this book. So the question is, do you believe in destiny? Do we have a destiny? How much do we control, and how much is fate?
Well, actually, the last three of my books have all been about the same subject. It's kind of fascinating in a way. I've been mulling this over for a very long time, even before this novel came along. My last book of long short stories was called Trajectory, and as the title suggests, that had something to do with fate and destiny too. It's all four of those stories are about people who wake up in their 50s, kind of scratching their heads and wondering, is this the life that I was supposed to lead? How did I come here? This wasn't what I planned. Something else has happened in the meantime. And then my book of essays was called The Destiny Thief, where I mulled over in kind of nonfiction form some of these things that puzzled me. And now chances are, you know, my own sense is that if somebody gave me 100 lives and this was just one of them, and then erased the memory of that life, and I got to do it all over again, my sense is that I would probably have another 99 different, very, very different outcomes. And probably, maybe there might be only one or two in which I was even a writer or an artist of any sort. I just don't have any sense that this life that I live, that I've been fortunate enough to live, is the only one out there. I think that there were other possible lives out there for me. And sometimes I even have a kind of shadow glimpse of what some of those others might have turned out, and most of them aren't nearly as blessed as the one that I actually have lived. And I've thought a lot about the fact that, you know, especially when you talk to people who have been blessed in one way or another, people who have been successful or blessed, and you ask them to tell the story of their lives, the story that they tell is very often based on free will. That is, those decisions that we make in life, as opposed to chance, which is just pure serendipity, and fate, which also, you know, like genetics, you don't have any control over that. And when successful people tell the story of their lives, basically what they do is ignore fate and they ignore chance and they talk about free will. I did this, I made this decision, this happened, and then I did this and this happened, and lo and behold, here I am, a self-made man. You know, that's the story that they like to tell. And I don't know whether or not that they're aware that it's a lie, but I do know that an awful lot of people born on third base seem to believe that they've hit triples, you know? And an awful lot of people, strangely enough, who were dealt really, really terrible hands with very few avenues towards success, strangely enough, blame themselves. You know, they've been dealt this almost unwinnable hand. And yet they're decent people, and they blame themselves, and they say, you know, I should have done this differently, or I should have done that differently. And so we have destinies, but we also have stories. We tell ourselves stories about the meaning of our lives, and we blame ourselves, we blame others. We all know the stories. We all know the stories of the guy who's in jail, and you say, why are you in jail? And he says, well, and the guy in jail says, well, the cop never should have come into the convenience store when he did, or I wouldn't have had to shoot him. Mm-hmm. You know, we tell these twisted stories of our lives. You know, the story well known now. Oh, I got a small $1 million loan from my father. You know, and now look at all the many, many millions, even billions, I turned that into. We tell these outright lies, I think, about our lives, and tragically, I think many times we believe them.
I was going to ask you. You've already answered it, but I had wondered, and I've observed that the stories we tell ourselves about fate kind of do break down along class lines.
I think so.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think a lot of things break down along class lines. Which is why I continue to mull about it, write about it. It's funny. One of the maxims of writing, of course, is write what you know, and there's a lot of truth to that. And I write a lot about what I know, but clearly I don't know enough, or I wouldn't be mulling over the same things I was mulling over, you know, 30, 35 years ago when I broke into writing as a young man. Here I am, you know, I was in my early 30s when Mohawk, or maybe middle 30s by the time Mohawk was published. So here I am 35 years later. Think about it, you know, 35 years later, I'm basically mulling over the same things that interested me when I was a much younger man, in much the same way that we find an author like Dickens. You know, you ask, you know, you read all of those Dickens novels, and if Dickens were alive and we could ask him, one of the questions we might ask is, what's with all the orphans? You know, why at the end of your life, so many books past Oliver Twist? Why does it seem almost impossible for Dickens to write a book that did not involve a major character who's an orphan? And you think, well, at some point, he must have felt like one. And that's the kind of thing that, of course, you never resolve, you never figure it out. And that's the good news, really. I mean, it's not a narrowness. It's not that you're wearing, as an author, you have blinders on and you can't think of anything else to write about. It's that Dickens and Faulkner and Willa Cather and Charlotte Bronte, they you know, were all haunted by by certain obsessions, and we keep returning to those, whether we want to or not. It seems like it sometimes.
Does that do you think include all of us? We have issues that we're dealing with from our youth, or is that just writers, do you think?
Well, certainly writers, but I think all of us. I think part of it is just that when we are kids and teenagers, the world is new, and when it's new, we learn it in a slightly different way. I mean, those early things that are imprinted upon the child's brain or the adolescent's brain, because it's so new, it gets imprinted really, really deep. And I think that what happens later in life, let's face it, there's a lot of repetition later in life. And so what happens when it happens to you, you think to yourself, well, I've certainly dealt with this before. I saw this coming. It's only happened 20,000 times to me. And so the world begins to feel not quite so new. And what we learn kind of reinforces what we already know, conclusions that we have already come to. But that stuff that happens early, that's a different kind of learning, a different kind of knowledge. We're not just tweaking anymore. You know, past the age of 20 or 25, we're dealing with software. Mm. Earlier than that, we're talking about hardware. Mm-hmm. You know, the right. Hardware of our lives.
Right.
And that's what we keep returning to. I think whether we're writers or artists or politicians or whatever, we're kind of in certain respects, the early years of our lives, that's our hardwiring.
Let's have 5 or 10 minutes left here. I definitely want to. You made an oblique reference to the president, and you've had this question, I'm sure, before. Some of the characters in your novels are, you know, small town. You deal with class issues. Some of the characters in your novels fit the profile of Trump supporters. I wonder.
They sure do.
Understand what their angst is and why they voted for the president.
I do. I've talked about this before on NPR. I talked about the election. I was invited to talk on National Public Radio the morning after the election, and I agreed to do so when I thought I knew who was going to win, and found that I had to go on and talk in some ways speak to at least NPR's part of the nation about what had happened, I certainly wouldn't speak for Trump voters. I wouldn't say, oh, I know why you did that. But I think I do have at least minimal insight because of where I grew up, how I grew up. A lot of my formative years were when I was working road construction with my father and all of his friends. I know what it's like to work with a pen in my hand, but I also know what it's like to work with a shovel. And I know what it's like to do the kind of hard work that my father and his friends did, and to not expect much money, and certainly never to be overpaid for anything, and to have money worries all the time, and to worry about losing your job. And I think that election. That election, what we said about it was that it was about jobs, but it was also about work, which I take to be the more important issue here, is that a lot of angry white men were concerned about losing their jobs, but they were more concerned about losing their work because it was their work that made them feel like they were part of the fabric of American society. That they were worth something. And I certainly saw that in the hometown that I grew up in, where most of that work went away long before it did in the rest of the United States. And I saw what happened to both men and women in tanneries and glove shops, who, if you had asked them in 1955 who they were as Americans, they would have been able to tell you that they made gloves in a city that produced most of the, like 90% of the dress the dress gloves worn by people throughout the United States. They would have told you that. They would have told you not about their economics. They would have told you about their work. They would have said, here's what I do as an American. Here's how I connect to the fabric of American society. And when all the glove shops closed and tanneries closed down, they not only lost their jobs, they not only lost their income, they lost their sense of who they were as Americans and that they were valuable as Americans. I think I know at least something of what was going on among Trump supporters. And the objection that I have to their anger is that what they were feeling was legitimate. Their loss of work, their loss of their sense of identity was legitimate. What they don't seem to grasp, and I wish they would, is that what they were feeling was not new. It was just not new to them. Black-skinned people and brown-skinned people had been feeling this. How far back do we need to go? You know, there are large groups of people who have always felt marginalized in America, who have never been sure of what their purpose was, whose livelihoods, not only their economic livelihoods, but their sense of themselves as valued Americans. And they say, if someone asks, what is your contribution to America? How do you feel about yourself as an American? There are an awful lot of people out there for a very long time who could not have answered that question with optimism. So I guess that's what I would say is those people want to build walls. You know, they want America to go back to a time when it wasn't pluralistic, when white people could be assured of that their whiteness was some sort of trump card. Well, okay, maybe bad choice of words there. I think I do know something about these folks, and I sympathize until I don't.
right. we're coming down near the end of our time. Just one more subject. This earlier in our conversation, you said this, among other things, was a novel about secrets and lies. I just want to quote a couple of things that you said in this interview I've been referencing that really struck me. You said, if you don't have secrets, you don't have an inner life.
Right.
And then connecting that with old friends, and the three protagonists in the novel are very old friends. You say most people become more skilled at dissembling over time, and our oldest friends knew us before we got good at it.
Yeah, yeah, and that's why some of those friendships are so powerful. And you know, I've always been an optimistic man and an optimistic writer, and my optimism has been sorely, sorely challenged over the last decade. And my work has gotten progressively darker because of what I've seen. And what we've all seen, and what we've all witnessed, what we've all lived through. But the optimism of this book, I think, lies in the friendship of these three men, whose friendship is sorely tested in this book. They have not shared the secrets of their inner lives, as we sometimes simply cannot. And because of their love for this girl and for various other reasons, they have not always been completely truthful. But there has never been a point in their lives where these guys haven't had profound affection and, yes, love for each other. And the optimism of this book is, I think, if they're in such as it is, is that if secrets and lies have the power to utterly destroy our lives, friendship and affection of the sort that these men display for each other is a powerful force that you do well not to underestimate, because it's pretty powerful.
Well, that's a good place to end the discussion. And added to everything we've been talking about, it's a page-turning mystery as well. So the book is Chances Are. It's the new novel from Richard Russo, who is winner of the Pulitzer Prize, author of Empire Falls and Nobody's Fool and many other books. Richard Russo, a great pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Tom. I enjoyed our conversation a lot.
And thanks for listening to Access Utah.